last year about the Terra Indigene and some of their deadliest forms. One rumor was that there was a form of Terra Indigene that could kill with just a look, and it could be recognized by its multicolored hair. So it was understandable that guests, when first seeing Inikei, might wonder what they were walking into. And in truth, there were some who looked at Inikei and walked back out, preferring to stay in the camper park at the edge of town, renting a camper that didn't have its own toilet, instead of staying in a clean room at the boarding house. An ensuite room if you were willing to pay extra for one of the boarding house's deluxe suites. Inikei was a good cook, but she wasn't much interested in baking. She left that to Dominique, one of the two young women who were somehow related to her and also worked for her. So when she showed up at the jumble as soon as she finished serving breakfast at the boarding house, set a large bag on my kitchen table, and pulled out tins of chocolate chip cookies, cinnamon muffins, double fudge brownies, and pecan caramel rolls, I didn't need to be a blood prophet to know she wanted something. "Is this a bribe?" I asked. "Of course it's a bribe." She sounded insulted that I had to ask. "Do you think I would bring this many treats for anything less?" Not when sugar and flour were still limited items that weren't always available. I selected a chocolate chip cookie from the tin and took a bite. Delicious. Wonderful. And I flashed to the memory of York giving me that smile and a little finger shake whenever I wanted to enjoy a sweet. Not gorge, mind you. Just have an end-of-the-meal sweet, a family tradition he insisted on, claiming that none of the members of his family had ever gotten fat by having a small sweet after dinner. But I still got that smile and finger shake at the end of every meal, or a mild scold about being wasteful when I turned down the sweet. I pushed aside memories that still soured my enjoyment of food most of the time while triggering a need to stuff my face. Feeling rebellious, I took another bite of the cookie. Why the bribe? People need time to get away from routine and relax. Now more than ever. And the Finger Lakes region has always been a popular destination. But the businesses in Sproing need something more than the Sproingers to give people a reason to stay here for a long weekend, instead of spending time at one of the other lakes. I've been thinking about ways to hook the tourists, and I have a proposal for you. Inikei helped herself to a brownie. I have an arrangement with the stable that adjoins the boarding house land. Horses for hire and boarding for privately owned animals. I used to love to ride when I was younger, but I hadn't gone over to see about hiring a horse for an hour or two. Too much to do and not enough money for indulgences. Okay, I said, just to show I was listening, because Inikei wasn't someone you wanted to annoy. I had boarded with her while the repairs and upgrades were being done on the Jumble's main house. She usually gave her boarders a couple of prunes in the morning, to keep the plumbing clear, and you didn't get the rest of your breakfast until you ate them. Feeding them to Inikei's dog Maxwell, who was a border collie with a touch of OCD when it came to locating and herding his people sheep, was a no-no. Maxwell loved prunes, but did not need to have his plumbing cleared, and the result of feeding him prunes was a messy eviction. Inikei was a lovely woman most of the time, but cross her, and she wouldn't hesitate to open a window and chuck your suitcase, and everything else you own onto the front lawn. And her aim was so good that at least half of what you owned landed in the dog's diarrhea. While I stayed with her, I ate my prunes and never, ever fed Maxwell table scraps of any kind. "I thought the stable closed," I said. "Well, the previous owner was eaten, and the hands ran off to wherever people were running last year. But it was taken over shortly afterward by Horace and Hector Adams. They're simple life folk. Cousins, I think." She shrugged to indicate their actual relationship was none of her business. "They aren't as strict about following simple life customs as some of their people, so they were willing to take over a business in a village that's a mix of people and customs." "What does that mean?" They use electricity for their appliances and lights, but don't own a television? Pretty much. They have a radio, but only listen to the news in the morning and an hour of music at night. They have a telephone because they're running a business, but don't have mobile phones. And they wear the traditional simple lifestyle of clothes. Inike knew more about who was doing what and where than anyone else in the village, including Jane Argyle, the postmistress, which was saying something. But while Jane might pass on gossip or a rumor indiscriminately, Inike passed on information only if she thought it was something someone needed to know. Last fall, we offered guided trail rides around Sproing, visiting a couple of the boutique wineries in the area, and giving visitors a chance to see some wildlife that wasn't looking for lunch. Even after the great predation, there were people who wanted to get away from home for a day or two, but didn't want to travel very far. People went to these wineries and sampled wines and then rode horses? Tall horses? Dominique or Paige looked after the riders. Well, the horses mostly looked after the riders, and knew enough to ignore the people on their backs and follow the girls. Anyway, I was thinking that, now that we're into the summer months and the heat is coming on, maybe we could arrange a guided trail ride through the jumble. There are plenty of bridle paths. We could start out at my place, ride for an hour or so, and end up at your place, where guests could enjoy a swim in the lake or just enjoy the quiet of your private beach. You've got that big screen porch across the back of the main house, so we would offer lunch there before my guests were guided back to the boarding house, passing the Milford's fruit stand on the way. I would supply the lunch, bring in enough for you and your lodgers, and would pay you 20% of the fee for the outing. You're charging for this? Of course I'm charging. Hiring the horses and making the meal isn't free. And access to your beach is part of the package, not something that can be had separately. Unless you decide to open the beach on your own. But if you do, you better charge enough for the privilege and have someone around who can enforce who gets in and who doesn't, or you'll be overrun. I'm not planning to make the beach available to anyone but my lodgers. I'd had enough trouble convincing people that the jumble and its beach was private property. I wasn't going to encourage people to think otherwise. On the other hand, this sort of setup would bring in a little money. It might even bring a guest or two if someone wanted to spend time on the lake and had to rent one of my little cabins to do it. I'm willing to give it a try, I said. I'll be sure to put a disclaimer on the sign-up sheet warning everyone that we aren't responsible for any injuries or accidents that are a result of anyone upsetting the Lady of the Lake. Inike finished her brownie and licked the frosting off her fingers. The Lady of the Lake? Silence. No one told you about her? Inike finally asked. I shook my head. She's Terra Indigene? Inike nodded. It's one of the smaller Finger Lakes, being barely 5 miles long and less than a mile across. But Silence is one of the deepest. No one knows what the lady is. People who might have seen her don't live to tell about it. Are you sure it's not just a story? I've been swimming out there. Well, taking a quick dip since the water isn't warm enough yet to do more, and haven't seen anything, not even a ripple. She's out there. Golly. Let's pick a couple of dates. Then I'll talk to Horace and Hector to make sure we can rent the horses, Inike said. I fetched my scheduling calendar, and we chose a couple of days. I'm limiting it to 6 guests, she said. We may not get that many the first time out, since my current boarders are police officers of one sort or another, but they shouldn't be around much longer. If I don't fill all the slots, I'll open it up to the Sproing residents, like the new owners of some of the stores. Julian Farrow's kind of dishy, don't you think? She looked at me and waggled her eyebrows. He certainly was dishy, and I liked him a lot, liked talking to him about books. Except for Inike, he was the only close friend I had in Sproing. But I didn't want more than friendship from anyone who had a vigorous appendage, no matter how dishy he might be. Shortly after coming to Sproing, I had read an article in an old magazine about what men expect when they're dating, It said men expected to have sex by the third date, which I found thoroughly intimidating because how could you know someone well enough in such a short amount of time to do something that intimate? Anyway, I was staying at Inike's when another guest, who was there for only a night, suggested we walk outside and take a look at the moon. Julian had loaned me a book about astronomy, and I had planned to go out to the back of the property that evening and see if I could identify a few constellations, so going out to look at the moon didn't seem odd. And when the man hinted that a kiss or two would be a lovely way to end the evening, well, that did seem a little pushy, but he'd been kind during dinner and had sounded interested in my opinions about a book we'd both read. And somehow, the way he'd phrased the hint made it sound like everyone would think I was being mean and selfish if I said no after he'd been so kind to me during dinner. I didn't want Inike or anyone else thinking I was mean and selfish, so I thought, he's only here for the night and only asking for a kiss. We'll never reach third date expectations. Why not see how it feels to kiss a man who isn't Yorick? But I found out too late that he thought my agreeing to a kiss meant I had agreed to do a lot more, and when I pushed him away because he started to do more, he said I should be grateful anyone wanted to give me a fuck, and suddenly he sounded so much like Yorick that... I don't remember much after that, except Maxwell barking and snapping at the man and Inike yelling. Then I was back in my room, hugging Maxwell, and Dr. Wallace was talking to Inike, and the man was gone. Before that night, I had daydreamed, just a little, about Julian maybe someday becoming more than a friend. After that night, I wasn't going to risk ruining the friendship I had in order to find out that wanting sex turned every man into a Yorick. When I didn't respond, Inike patted my hand and pushed away from the kitchen table. I walked her to her car. She looked around, scanning the trees. No sign of Aggie or any other crow. The crime investigators are at the boarding house, and not just as guests, Inike said. The man who was killed was staying in one of my rooms. The investigators searched the room yesterday, and they're doing it again this morning. It seems they can't find something they expected to find. So they know who he is. I breathed a sigh of relief. That's good. I'm not so sure it's good. She sounded grim. Listen, Vicky, I heard something that makes me think that they think the man knew you, was coming to see you.
I didn't know him.
Okay, I hadn't taken a good look at him since he had the missing eyeballs and I felt a bit squeamish.
I didn't have an appointment with anyone, wasn't expecting anyone. She studied me.
All the same, if the investigators want to have a chat with you, I'd be real careful about what I said, and I would think hard about having a lawyer present before saying anything to them.
Inike drove away, and I was left wondering where I would find a lawyer if I needed one. As I went back to the house, I noticed the crow on the ground near a tree. Aggie?
Caw!
A soft sound. A treble sound. Just how much had she heard? Around noon, two unmarked cars drove up to the house, and I wondered if I should have paid more attention to Inike's quiet warning and spent some time looking for a lawyer who would represent me if I needed one.
Miss Devine.
Two men got out of the car first. The older man had an insincere, oil-slick smile that reminded me too much of Yorick when he was talking a chump into some kind of deal. The younger one, who introduced himself as Officer Osgood, seemed uncomfortable with his partner, or superior, or whatever Mr. Oilslick was in the CIU hierarchy. Or was that Detective Oilslick? Since he hadn't introduced himself, that name would do.
"We'd like you to come down to the station and answer a few questions,"
Oilslick said.
"Why?"
I stayed where I was, within reach of my front door. My heart pounded, and I was getting that feeling in my arms and legs like I was suddenly wrapped in another skin that was two sizes too small, a warning sign of excessive stress. I already told Officer Grimshaw everything I knew. My lodger found the body yesterday, and I called the police.
It appears the victim was here to discuss your squatting on land that belongs to your ex-husband's family.
I beg your pardon?
That anxiety skin wrap tightened a little more.
I am not squatting. The jumble was part of my divorce settlement. Whether it used to be family land or not, my ex-husband was happy to unload it on me.
Then it clicked.
Oh, did he send that man to see if I'd sunk enough money into the place and made enough improvements to make it worth his while to try to get it back?
Typical Yorick. And typical me that it took me 10 years to see his true nature. Of course, he'd been very good at making me believe that what I knew was true was really me making things up and getting confused.
Four other men stepped out of the second vehicle.
You don't mind if my men look around, do you?
Oil Slick asked.
In another minute, I was going to break down into uncontrollable weeping, and Oil Slick would be able to push me into agreeing with whatever he wanted to do. But until that moment...
You think you can come into my house and look around? Maybe paw through cupboards and drawers and find things to substantiate your allegations?
You've become overexcited, Miss Devine,
Oil Slick warned.
Pretending to have hysterics isn't going to change anything. You are coming to the station with us to answer some questions.
Exactly where is this station?
Okay, I like reading thrillers. So I had this sudden image of me being driven away to some unknown destination and questioned until I confessed to whatever they wanted to hang on me.
In sprawling.
Oil Slick looked past me.
In the meantime.
A hand latched onto my wrist, and Aggie pressed against my back and whispered,
Tell them what they are not allowed to do at your house. Say it really loud.
I didn't see how saying something really loud was any better than speaking in a normal volume, but I did what she suggested, if for no other reason than it seemed like a way to relieve a bit of stress.
No one is allowed to enter my house until I return. No one can open my car and look for alleged evidence. No one can enter the cabins and look around. No one is allowed to leave anything on my property. You can all stand outside and look at the trees, but that is all you are allowed to do.
Oil Slick lost even the veneer of courtesy as I listed, loudly, the things he and his men could not do.
We can get a warrant to search your place, he said. If we have to get a warrant, it will look like you have something to hide.
Until you have that warrant, you don't set a toe inside any of these buildings.
I felt very brave. Or very light-headed. It was hard to tell.
Now, I'll get my purse and lock up, then I'll follow you to the station.
You'll be riding with us, and you're not entering the house to destroy evidence while you're looking for your purse.
I could stand just outside the door,
Officer Osgood said,
if Miss Devine leaves the door open.
Then things got strange.
My friends are here,
Aggie whispered. One crow, then three more. Then a dozen flew into the trees around the house. A dozen more took up position on the roof. The biggest hawk, or hawk, I had ever seen landed on the roof of Oil Slick's car, and I'm sure it deliberately scraped its talons over the surface in a bird version of keying a car to put gouges in the paint. As I looked at the hawk, it occurred to me that, until the car was repainted, those gouges would be so easy to spot from a bird's view of the roads. A gust of air blew through the trees, making the leaves sound like sinister tambourines. And something nearby, and unseen, growled.
Miss Vicky told you the rules,
Aggie said. She sounded a lot less like a teenager who was on her own than she usually did.
Everyone will make sure you humans follow the rules.
You humans. Battle line drawn.
Get your purse,
Oil Slick said. I expected Aggie to keep holding on to my wrist, but she turned and ran to the back of the house. I got a glimpse of her clothing,
and would need to talk to her about wearing something more than a sheer cotton nightie when there were visitors, especially when there were male visitors. I fetched my purse, made sure the back porch's screen door was properly latched, and the kitchen door was locked. While I was far enough into the house not to be heard, I pulled out my mobile phone and called Inike, leaving a message on her answering machine, telling her the CIU investigators were taking me to the Sproing police station. Or so they claimed. I finished the message with the time, so she would know exactly when I had left. If Oil Slick was taking me somewhere else, maybe the time of departure would be useful, assuming anyone tried to find me. I made sure Officer Osgood saw me lock the front door, both regular lock and deadbolt. I made sure Oil Slick saw me tuck the keys into the big purse I used when I figured I would need everything. I have copies of the divorce papers, the settlement, and the deed to the jumble in my safe deposit box at the bank. And no, I won't give you my safe deposit key so that you can fetch the papers. It was finally sinking in that something was far from right about all of this, including the presence of the man who had died on my land.
Then we'll stop there first, Oil Slick said.
He made it sound like he was going to have to go miles out of his way when the bank was right next door to the police station. If he parked anywhere on Main Street, he wouldn't have to move his car in order to get from one place to the other.
Car! 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 Car!
Whether the crows were acknowledging the destination or issuing a warning didn't matter. There were close to 24 feathered witnesses who knew where I was supposed to be in a few minutes from now. As I was escorted to the first unmarked car by Oil Slick, and one of the unnamed detectives who had been in the second car, I looked around. But I couldn't tell if Aggie was among the crows watching us. If she hadn't rented one of the cabins, I wouldn't have had even this much support, and no one around to see what might happen. Chapter 7. Aggie. Sunday, June 13th. Aggie flew across Lake Silence as fast as she could. This was bad. This was so very, very bad. If she'd just eaten the squishy eyeball instead of bringing it back to the house to warm up in the wave cooker, the police humans wouldn't be causing trouble for Miss Vicky, because they wouldn't have known about the dead man. But Miss Vicky had seen the eyeball and done what she felt was right by human rules, and now she was in trouble. The crow guard would keep watch around the jumble, would even attack the humans if they disobeyed Miss Vicky's rules. But police humans had guns, and that made them an especially dangerous breed. So the crow guard weren't enough protection. Not alone. And they didn't know enough about human rules. But she knew someone who did know about human rules and might be willing to help. She flew across the lake until she reached Silence Lodge, landing on the top level of the multi-level deck that stretched across the back of the lodge. She shifted to a feathered but mostly human form, gathered her courage, and knocked on the door. Chapter 8. Grimshaw. Sunday, June 13th. Grimshaw debated with himself if he wanted lunch enough to brave the inquisitive stares and prying questions he was bound to get the moment he walked in to Come and Get It, the local diner. He'd already been grilled by Inike Xavier when he asked about renting a room for a few days. She hadn't been keen to rent her last room to him, one of her rooms being a crime scene, and the rest being appropriated by Detective Marmaduke Swin and his CIU team. But when she understood that he wasn't part of the CIU team, she'd been willing to rent him the room with the ensuite bathroom that she'd refused to give up for the CIU team. He didn't know what Swin had done to tick her off that she'd held back her best room, and he didn't care. He was just glad to have the room. And equally glad the CIU boys had been out and about when he arrived, Swin had made it clear yesterday that he wasn't needed or welcome in their investigation. So showing up today as the new, if temporary, official police force in Sproing wasn't going to make for cordial dinners at the boarding house. As he wondered how he was supposed to send Hargreaves reports about an investigation he couldn't get near, Grimshaw watched Julian Farrow cross the street and make his way through the mob of Sproingers that had gathered in front of the bank and police station. He waited until Julian entered the station and closed the door.
Has this ever happened before?
No.
Julian sounded grim.
Listen, Wayne. I just got a call from Inike Xavier. Apparently, Vicky Devine is being brought in for questioning. Not surprising. A dead body was found on her land, and the CIU boys will want an official statement.
Grimshaw frowned.
If Inike was concerned, why did she call you instead of me? I gave her my mobile phone number, as well as the number for the station. You're still an unknown commodity. Highway patrol officer temporarily reassigned here, bringing with you a carry-all that couldn't hold more than a couple of changes of clothes, and a suit bag that probably has your other uniform, and maybe a couple of dress shirts. Did you count my underwear the moment I was out of the room? My point is, no one knows where you stand.
Julian stood next to him at the window. Both of them watched the Sproingers. People going into or out of the bank could get around them. The critters did move out of the way, but they didn't move far. And if they suddenly felt inclined to attack someone's ankles or lower legs, a person had no room to maneuver.
You need to be the good cop in this, Wayne. I don't think Miss Devine thinks of me as a good cop. Then you better do something to change her mind,
Julian snapped. Grimshaw studied the man who had been his friend. Maybe still was his friend. A man who had an uncanny sense of what was happening in a place.
Okay. I'll be the good cop.
Julian nodded.
I told you that you'll need to be careful about choosing your allies. Make sure everyone knows you're the good cop.
He looked pointedly at the Sproingers.
And I do mean everyone. Crap.
An unmarked car pulled into one of the parking spaces in front of the bank. The Sproingers snapped to attention. Grimshaw settled his duty belt and put on his hat.
Looks like that's my cue.
He walked outside just as one of the CIU boys opened the car's back door.
Excuse me, fellas,
Grimshaw said, looking at the Sproingers crowded around his legs.
I need to give the lady a hand.
They moved out of his way, giving him a clear path to the CIU car, but closing ranks behind him. He reached the car at the same time Vicky Devine stepped out of the vehicle, swaying a little. The CIU man stared at her, so Grimshaw took a long step forward and extended his hand. She grabbed it. He wasn't sure she even knew whose hand she held. Damn it, the woman was shaking. And if he was any judge of body language, she was a couple of breaths away from a complete meltdown.
Anything I can do for you, Miss Devine?
He asked.
We've got it covered,
the CIU man said. She looked at him and seemed to focus, and he wondered exactly what had happened during that car ride from the jumble. The detective claims I'm squatting at the jumble. He wants to see the paperwork that proves the land is mine. We're going into the bank to open my safe deposit box.
Do you want someone to go in with you?
She focused on him a little more, as if who he was and what he was saying was finally getting through. Thank you, Officer Grimshaw. That would be appreciated.
Not necessary, officer.
Marmaduke Swin came around the car to the sidewalk. He looked like he wanted to dropkick a Sproinger or two to the other side of the street. The Sproingers who stared back at him were not wearing their happy faces.
Serve and protect,
Grimshaw smiled, and wondered what would happen if he pointed at Swin and said,
That is a very bad man.
How would the Sproingers react to such a statement? Would they shift to a Terra Indigene form that had a predator's teeth and claws? He estimated there were 30 of them filling the sidewalk in front of the bank and police station. If they had a lethal form, those were not good odds.
Let's take a look at those papers and get this sorted out, he said.
He released Vicky's hand, cupping her elbow instead to provide her with some support as they walked into the bank, trailed by Swin and his man. The bank manager stood near the teller windows and looked startled when Grimshaw walked in. Then he exchanged a quick look with Swin. Crap. What was going on between those two? The bank manager had expected Swin to come in with Vicky Devine, but Grimshaw's presence made the man nervous enough to sweat, which meant a cop who wasn't part of Swin's team was a problem for them.
Surely we don't need so many people, he said as he fetched his keys and had Miss Devine sign the log.
Grimshaw gave the bank manager the look that made any wrongdoer squirm, and the man was squirming. The safe deposit box was removed from the vault and brought to the small room where people could add or remove things in private. Since the room wasn't bigger than a typical elevator and had a counter and chair taking up part of the space, the second CIU man stayed outside. The room was still crowded with four people. Grimshaw knew why he and Swin were in the room, but why had the bank manager been allowed to stay? Was he supposed to be the witness to whatever was found in the box?
They're gone, Vicky Devine said, staring at the empty box. The papers are gone, and the money. I had $6,000 in the box. This is a bank, Swin said, while the bank manager insisted that nothing could have been taken. Why didn't you deposit the money? It doesn't earn interest sitting in the box.
She stared at him. It also isn't lost if the bank goes under. This is a small institution, not a regional bank. Plenty of small banks went under in the past year. I wasn't taking that chance.
Have a few trust issues? Grimshaw murmured.
Yes. She had color in her face again. He figured if she was pissed off, she was less likely to faint. That worked for him.
Takes two keys to open the box, Swin said. I think you weren't being honest with us, Miss Devine. I know what was in the box, she protested. But you can't prove it.
Swin looked triumphant, like he'd made the winning point.
That's right, the bank manager nodded vigorously. You can't prove it. Of course I can, she snapped. I made a list of everything I put in the box, and I took photos of all the items to corroborate the list.
More than a few trust issues, and a bit obsessive to boot. But Grimshaw was more interested in the way the bank manager started sweating again. Yes, opening the box required two keys. That didn't mean someone couldn't have made a duplicate before handing over the customer's key.
The papers are missing, so you have no proof to your claim, Swin said. I told you, those were copies,
Vicky Devine replied.
The originals are in a lockbox in my bedroom at the Jumble.
Grimshaw focused his attention on Swin before asking Vicky Devine,
Is there anyone at your place to keep an eye on things? I have a couple of men there,
Swin said, as if the question had been aimed at him.
I think so, Vicky said. Maybe.
Grimshaw nodded.
All right, then. We can drive back to the Jumble and... She still has to answer some questions about the man who was killed on her property, Swin snapped. A moment ago, you were certain it wasn't her property. Don't screw with me, Grimshaw. I've read your file, officer.
Yep. He did not work or play well with others, especially assholes like Swin, which was one of the reasons he was still just an officer, while other men were promoted over him. But Swin's reaction made him think the dead man was just the tip of the iceberg, and Julian Farrow was right. There was something wrong in Sproing.
Miss Devine?
Grimshaw waited until he had her attention.
Let's get your safe deposit box locked up again, and then we'll go over to the station. What's the point of locking up an empty box? She asked. No point at all, he thought.
but he wondered how many of Sproing's citizens were going to empty out their boxes once word got out that their valuables weren't any safer in the bank than they would be under the bed. Chapter 9. Vicky. Sunday, June 13th. We hadn't gone more than a couple of steps past the bank when a black luxury sedan with tinted windows glided into a parking space in front of the police station. It was so shiny, like road dust didn't dare touch its surface. Maybe they used a special wax that repelled dirt. If I asked the driver, would he tell me? My little green car was more a mottled brown these days, what with driving up the gravel access road to the Jumbles' main house. Then a man got out of the back seat. He was yummy. I mean, he was a double scoop sundae with hot fudge and caramel sauce and a mountain of real whipped cream yummy. His hair was darker than Inike's double fudge brownies, and he had the most luscious melted chocolate eyes. He smiled at me, and I tried to move toward him, but Officer Grimshaw gripped my arm and wouldn't move at all. Didn't he know that gorgeous men never smiled that way at dumpy women with unruly hair? Stupid man. I'm Ms. Devine's attorney, Yummy said. I would like to speak to my client in private. We can use my office. He pointed toward the second floor of the police station. Then he handed Grimshaw a business card. He was who? I was what? Crap. It was one of Grimshaw's breathed rather than spoken words. You're not a public defender, Swin said, pushing forward. And she can't afford anything more. Too true, especially since someone stole the emergency fund I'd kept in the safe deposit box. I will speak with my client in private, Yummy attorney said. His eyes didn't look like melted chocolate anymore. Then you can talk to her in the station. We have a little room in the back just for that, Swin said. Sure, go ahead and smirk. Mr. Sanguinati and Miss Devine can talk in the front room if that's acceptable, Grimshaw said. Sangua. Oh, it figured he wouldn't be a regular guy. Then again. Grimshaw released my arm, and I sort of teetered into the police station, followed by the yummy vampire attorney. I took one of the visitor's seats. He brought the other visitor's chair over and sat facing me, our knees almost touching. Then he leaned forward and took my hands. You're trembling, Miss Devine. He rubbed a thumb over my knuckles. Was that supposed to calm me down? Especially when he was looking at me as if I might be a plain vanilla cone, but that was just what he was in the mood for. Did those men hurt you in any way? What men? Are you unwell? Something was upsetting him, and when he glanced toward the door of the police station, I began to put it together. I wasn't the sharpest crayon in the box at that moment. Stress does that to me. But like I said, I read a lot of thrillers, so I finally put the questions together. On the TV shows, the good guys refer to it as non-physical interference or psychological intimidation. That's what he wanted to know. Was his client shaking because of something that had been done? Trouble was, I'd developed a technique throughout my childhood and my marriage to Yorick where I would go to a safe and secret place in my mind. A closet that had a blankie and bunny slippers. A place no one else could find. I'd still hear whatever was being said to me or about me. Still hear the list of my failings, but it was muffled by a thick door. So I heard and didn't hear. Within a minute of driving away from the Jumble, I'd slammed that secret closet door shut. So I had absorbed, but hadn't processed, what Detective Oilslick Swin had said to me. I didn't come out of the closet until Grimshaw took my hand, and I understood it was safe to be completely present again. Not willing to pull away, I twisted my wrist to look at my watch. Huh, it's past lunchtime. I get a little shaky when I'm stressed and forget to eat. and I hadn't eaten anything that day except the cookie, which was not smart.
Wait here.
He gave my hands a squeeze and stood up. Then he paused.
I didn't properly introduce myself.
I'm Ilya Sanguinati. My attorney.
Yes.
I sighed. I appreciate the offer. I really do. But frankly, Mr. Sanguinati, I couldn't afford to pay for a sleeve of that very nice suit you're wearing, let alone your hourly rates.
We can work out the payment plan.
I stared at him. A payment plan? I could guess what the interest might be while a person was paying off the principal on the bill. But he was so yummy. And really, what's a pint or two of blood between a girl and her attorney when she gets to have her neck nibbled by that mouth? And since neck nibbling wasn't the same as having sex, I was pretty sure I could handle it as well as the girls in the romances I'd read last week. I'd sure be willing to give it a try. He opened the door partway and spoke to someone. I heard oil slick swin squawk when Ilya Sanguinati closed the door and returned to the other seat.
Now, he said, tell me how you came to be the caretaker of the jumble and what you know about the human who had the poor taste to die on your land.
Being dead is more inconvenient to him than it is to me, I pointed out. His shoulders moved in what might have been a shrug. The movement was almost too subtle to see, but for all I knew, it could have been a wild, unrestrained gesture for someone like him. I skipped the part about York's vigorous appendage and explained about receiving the jumble and some cash as my settlement in the divorce. I was happy to leave Hub N.E., a.k.a. Hubney, since I wanted a fresh start and had hoped to turn the jumble into a viable business that would provide me with a living. The fact that the property was on the western end of the Finger Lakes area was perfect, since it was a happy distance from Hubney and my former hubby. I blamed low blood sugar for not being able to sound as upbeat and sassy as I wanted to sound. But Ilya Sanguinati didn't roll his eyes, or sneer, or make cute but cutting remarks. He just listened. I finished telling him about Aggie and the eyeball, which had led to me reporting the inconveniently dead man moments before someone knocked on the station door. Julian walked in.
I wasn't sure what you needed in the way of food, so I guessed. Grilled cheese sandwich and a chocolate milkshake. And there's a small bowl of sliced strawberries because Helen at the diner said you should have a little fruit with your meal.
This is great, thank you. Julian set out the food on the desk blotter and pulled out the rolling desk chair.
Now, Ilya Sanguinati said, once I was seated behind the desk. Let's get this settled.
My stomach rolled. He raised a hand.
You eat and listen. I'll get this settled. And then we'll go back to the jumble and take a look at the paperwork.
I noticed Julian took up a position behind me and a little to one side when the other man walked into the station.
Officer Grimshaw took up a position at the far corner of the desk. And Ilya Sanguinati stood in front of the desk. It was like having a force field made out of male bodies, so I felt safe enough to stay out of the mental closet and listen while I ate my lunch. Really good grilled cheese sandwich. Helen wouldn't say what she did to make them so good. A blend of cheeses, I think. But they were one of my favorite comfort foods when I ate at the diner. Detective Swin came in, attempting to swagger. He had a swagger attitude, but not the build to pull it off. Rather like York that way. The bank manager was the last one in. I guess the other CIU man wasn't invited to the party.
Now, Ilya Sanguinati said, let's come to some small understanding.
Ms. Devine has to answer some questions, Swin said.
My attorney ignored the CIU investigator and focused on the bank manager.
As we speak, two of my kin who deal with banks and banking issues are at the bank examining the contents of all the safe deposit boxes held by the residents of Silence Lodge. Like Miss Devine, we keep a detailed list of everything we allow the bank to hold.
I looked at the bank manager, then at the dill pickle spear that had come with my sandwich. They were the same shade of green. I nudged the pickle to one side and concentrated on the sandwich. More of my kin, the ones who are most interested in commerce and real estate, are also at the bank, withdrawing the funds we have on deposit.
But you can't, the bank manager said. If you withdraw that much...
The bank will no longer be a healthy, viable institution. Ilya Sanguinati smiled. I must also inform you that the lease for the building, which is owned by Silence Lodge, will not be renewed unless two conditions are met.
But there isn't another building in Sproing that's suitable to be a bank. Not without extensive renovations, the bank manager protested.
I know. That smile again. I blinked. Had I seen a hint of Fang? What are your conditions? Officer Grimshaw asked.
Miss Devine will return tomorrow morning and open her safe deposit box. If the missing papers and the missing $7,000 have reappeared...
It was $6,000, the bank manager said.
Now it's $7,000. Wow, this was better than the crime drama I'd watched on TV last week. A light finger tap on the back of the chair reminded me that I was supposed to be eating. But really, talk about bloodless bloodletting.
The second condition is that you resign your position as bank manager before tomorrow morning. You will not retain any position with this bank. If those conditions are met, and we have not discovered any discrepancies in our safe deposit boxes, then we will restore enough of our funds to assist the bank in remaining solvent.
Now my attorney turned to the CIU investigator, but a movement at the window caught my attention.
Is that a Sproinger?
I pointed at the face in the window.
Do they get that big?
Ilya Sanguinati looked toward the window, then at me.
No. They are doing... Athletic human girls do this trick during sporting events.
A pyramid? They've made a Sproinger pyramid?
I looked at the Sproinger. He or she made the happy face.
Can I get a picture?
If I got out of this in one piece, I was going to buy an I Heart Sproinger's t-shirt. Silence.
Sorry, I muttered. Brain-to-mouth disconnect.
There are several people standing in the street taking pictures, including Dominique Xavier, Julian said. I'm sure she'll give you one.
This banking business is beside the point, Swin said. There are questions about why the dead man was lured to the jumble.
I agree, Ilya Sanguinati replied. But you've already received the medical examiner's preliminary report. So you know there's no possible way that Miss Devine could have killed that man.
More silence.
What did kill him?
Grimshaw asked.
I secured the scene, but was relieved when the CIU team began their investigation.
Spinal injury.
That's not public knowledge,
Swin said, sounding unsure of himself.
It is to us.
Ilya Sanguinati looked at me.
Finished your lunch?
You can bring the milkshake with you. Even Oil Slick Swin stepped out of the way when my attorney escorted me and the milkshake to his fancy black car. The driver, another Sanguinati judging by his looks, opened the back door for me, and Ilya Sanguinati blocked any attempt by Swin to get close before we drove away.
Thanks.
I didn't know what else to say. Okay, I did know something else to say. Why are you doing this?
You have been kind to Aggie. You are the first person since Honoria Dane to show some understanding about the nature of the jumble.
Which is... His eyes were back to looking like melted chocolate.
That it was built within a Terra Indigene settlement, with the understanding that the human caretaker would help those interested in learning to correctly mimic human ways.
Oh.
Wow. That explained a few things about Aggie. She was the test volunteer to see if I was suitable. Now I wish I had talked to her about the nighty.
There is no objection to your having human lodgers as well, as long as they are tolerant of their neighbors. I sipped the milkshake to give myself time to think.
Does everyone know that about the jumble?
That it's really a Terra Indigene settlement? During Honoria's time? I would think many of the residents in Sproing knew. Whether anyone outside the village understood. He did that subtle shoulder movement.
That explained why Yorick's family always said Great-Great's business venture was a failure. They hadn't known what she'd really built, or why.
Yes, visionary and eccentric. Maybe I could be like her when I grew up.
I looked out the window just as we passed the sign for Mill Creek Lane, which meant we'd missed the turn from our road. When we finally turned down an unmarked gravel road that I was pretty sure was on the other side of the lake, I started feeling nervous. I thought we were going back to the jumble to look at my papers.
Not just yet, Ilya Sanguinati replied. I am confident those papers are in order, or as much as they need to be. We're going to Silence Lodge so that you can assist me in reviewing some other papers.
What other papers?
He smiled, but there was a little bit of an edge to it. The ones the dead man was carrying.
Chapter 10 Grimshaw Sunday, June 13th. Detective Swin gave Grimshaw a look that would have scorched paint. Then he turned that look on Julian before he walked out of the police station.
He doesn't like us,
Julian said. Grimshaw blew out a breath.
He's going to run a background check on you. Someone usually does sooner or later. And then that someone suggests that you move on. Why would the Sanguinati be interested in Vicky Devine?
He asked.
Might be as simple as she's the person who has control of the jumble, Julian replied. She arrived in Sproing last fall and started renovating the main house and some of the cabins with an eye to having things ready for the summer, when you'd expect people to want to rent a place for a weekend getaway or a lakeside vacation. As far as I know, this is the first time the Sanguinati have made contact with her. If the vampires own as many buildings in this village as Ilya Sanguinati implied, then how did everyone pretend the others kept their distance from the people who live here?
Julian hesitated.
In another place where I lived for a while, I took a job as a land agent. The person who collected the rent and arranged for repairs and listened to complaints. It was a small community like this one. And the humans swore there had never been a sighting of any kind of Terra Indigene in their village, despite the fact that they lived around the Adirondack Mountains. And occasionally, when the ground was soft after rain, they would find huge prints under a window. Evidence that something stood on its hind legs to look into the second-story window. There was a man in that town who had a side business making plaster casts of those prints. People would hang them on the walls of their family rooms and show them to guests. And they still swore the others didn't prowl the streets at night. That some of the particularly gruesome deaths that occurred weren't caused by a large, angry predator. Wayne, a lot of people stay sane by pretending the Terra Indigene are out there, and not the individual sitting next to you at the counter in the diner. The only lodger currently at the jumble is one of the Crow Guard, Grimshaw said. Vicky knows? If she didn't know before, she does now. But the Crow is still there?
Still there.
A hesitation.
The Crow she knows about may not be the only Terra Indigene living in one of the cabins, or, at the very least, living on the land connected to the jumble.
The phone rang. As Grimshaw reached for the receiver, he said,
That did occur to me.
Then,
Sproing Police Station.
Officer down! Officer needs assistance!
Gods,
there weren't any other cops in the area except...
Where are you?
The jumble.
Can you hold your position?
Yes.
We're on our way. Grimshaw hung up and called the Bristol Police Station's number.
This is Officer Grimshaw in Sproing. Tell Captain Hargreaves I've got a situation at the jumble.
Officer down and another officer requesting assistance. I'm heading there now. I need whoever you can send me.
Isn't there a CIU team in the area? Can't they supply backup?
The dispatcher asked.
I think it's the CIU team that got hit.
A heartbeat of silence.
I'll put out the call.
Grimshaw hung up the phone and looked at Julian.
You're coming with me.
No. Julian took a step back.
I'm not a cop anymore. I don't have a gun.
Grimshaw headed for the door.
You still have a gun. After what you went through, you wouldn't leave yourself without a weapon. I need someone to back me up, Julian. Someone I can trust.
He went out the door. He wasn't an intuit like Julian, but he had a feeling that the man he remembered, the man who had been a damn good cop, wouldn't let him go into trouble alone.
You can take the shotgun, he said when Julian got into the passenger seat. Which one of them called?
Julian asked. Grimshaw pulled out of the parking space and made a U-turn to head for the jumble, lights flashing and sirens screaming.
Magus, the baby cop. Before Swin sent me on my way, I saw a kid with the team who didn't look old enough to be in CIU. Barely looked old enough to have graduated from the academy. Swin is his commanding officer. Why didn't the kid call him? Maybe because Swin is his commanding officer.
Grimshaw concentrated on driving for a minute. Then he pulled a business card out of his shirt pocket.
Call Ilya Sanguinati and warn him not to take Vicky Devine home until we know what's going on.
Julian took the card and pulled out his mobile phone.
Mr. Sanguinati?
Julian said when the vampire answered the call.
There's some trouble at the jumble.
Officer Grimshaw is on his way there now.
Could you... I see.
Pause.
Yes, I understand. I appreciate the information.
He ended the call. The hand holding the mobile phone flopped into his lap. Grimshaw spared a glance at his friend, who looked unnaturally pale.
What? Mr. Sanguinati is taking Vicky to Silence Lodge. He said the elders aren't happy with humans at the moment, but the police will be safe enough to retrieve the survivor as long as no weapons are drawn.
He barely checked the reflex to slam on the brakes.
Elders? Gods, Julian.
When people spoke of the others, they thought of the vampires or the ones who could shift to animal forms like wolves and bears and, yes, crows. But as threats to humans went, those kinds of Terra Indigene paled in comparison to the Terra Indigene that were known as the Elders and the Elementals. They had been the killing force that had swept across the continent of Thasia last summer, across the whole damn world. Unlike the shifters and vampires who might let a human live if the encounter was peaceful, the Elders weren't that tolerant. A fact every police officer who did highway patrol recognized. Those men traveled the roads through the wild country every single day, and every day there was the chance that something watching from the verge would decide not to let the human driving the noisy metal box with the flashing lights live to reach his destination.
He say anything else?
He said you should request an ambulance, or whatever vehicle carries the dead when police answer a call. And you should bring some body bags. Grimshaw slowed as he made the turn onto the gravel road that led to the jumble's main house. He cut the siren, but could hear other sirens in the distance coming closer. Backup. Help.
He hoped.
They saw the unmarked car where it had landed just off the gravel road. What was left of a car? Something had smashed the trunk and roof, punched in the doors, broken all the windows, and ripped off the front tires. Made sure the vehicle, and the people, couldn't escape.
Let me out here,
Julian said.
I'll see what I can do for anyone inside the car. You'll be in the open. Exposed.
Grimshaw protested.
I won't be carrying a weapon, so I should be safe enough.
The baby cop was still up ahead, so they had to split up
in case anyone in the car was still alive.
"Watch your back," he said.
Julian opened the door but hesitated.
"I have the feeling we'll be all right as long as everyone remains calm and professional. And if fear makes someone twitchy,